Don't nobody move, ladies and gentlemen, because I've got a really fun and interesting and musical and talented guest here in the neighborhood tonight with me. His name is Tony Powers, and those of you who know him, well, you might know his face from a bunch of small roles and cameos and various films that he's done over the past few years. But the main reason that I knew him, and I mentioned this towards the top of the show, was back in the pretty early days of MTV, when they were still taking chances on stuff and everything wasn't prepackaged and just for little budding teenagers. They were still trying to figure out what would work or trying to find things to play to fill a music channel that was on 24/7. And so they took a chance on a weird, funny, creepy, very bouncy, jazzy video film by a guy named Tony Powers, where he did three different songs and kind of this almost video noir piece of his. That's actually an award-winning piece. And the most popular one of that was a song called Don't Nobody Move, This Is a Heist. And it was one of those cult numbers. It stuck in your head forever. And you tell people about it. It's like, did you see that video? Did you see what? It was so cool. And not much really happened, at least on a big scale, after that. And I was always wondering for years, whatever happened to Tony Powers? Where did he go? He had that amazing song. He had that video. What happened? And so tonight, finally, now granted, I figured out what happened a couple of weeks ago by Googling and Wikipediaing and all that stuff, but it's more fun to get it from the actor-singer's mouth. And so here, in the neighborhood, please welcome everybody, Tony Powers. How are you doing, Tony?
Nice intro. I'm good, Dave.
Thank you, Tony. So tell me, so between 1980 blah, 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 and now, where have you been?
Where have I been? I've been writing what I felt like writing, for one thing.
Uh-huh.
I just didn't feel like writing any more commercial stuff that everybody wants to hear. I've been an actor, and I had a pretty big role in Cadillac Man. I don't know if you saw that Robin Williams film.
Well, I've seen the film, but I wouldn't have really thought to look for you, and I guess I should have read the credits.
Oh, I had a huge role. I was Captain Mason, and that was pretty good. And I've done TV, you know, NYPD Blue a couple of times.
Well, you have that kind of face. I mean, not an unhandsome face, but it's certainly, it's a Scorsese face, if people know what I'm saying, you know?
I was in Goodfellas.
Oh, well, there you go.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was Jimmy two times in Goodfellas.
Now, did you resent being cast that way, or did you say, hey, this is Hollywood, that's how they're going to cast me?
Oh, not at all. I mean, you know, you're an actor, you want to work.
Right.
And in fact, the bad guys are more fun to play.
So what was your favorite part that you have played? Was it in Cadillac Man, or was it Jimmy?
In Cadillac Man, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a fun shoot, and it was a big role, and I had a great time doing it, and fun to work with Robin Williams, who kept everybody entertained.
Is it true what I've heard about Robin Williams and the fact that when the camera stopped rolling, he can't shut it off?
Oh, he's spectacularly funny at all times.
Yeah, even when he's
he
on.
Doesn't stop.
Yeah.
He has a great mind. His mind is so brilliant, and he doesn't have a censor. He just lets it out.
And there's no moment when you just say, Robin, it's okay. You know, it's just me. We're just actors. We're having lunch. You don't have to be. He can't not be funny. That's why I'm
Well, I've also hung out with Robin in the 80s. We used to hang out at a place called the Cafe Central. And he has a serious side, and he has his moments. But, I mean, let's face it. His mind perceives how comical the human condition is. You know what I mean?
Oh, well.
So at all times, something is funny going on. If you are an observer of the human condition, it's kind of funny, and in a way, what the condition we're in.
Now, since I kind of forced you to name drop there a little bit, but I'm also wondering, here you were in the early part of your career, your musical career, when you started getting that video together, and you know, I'm assuming nobody had really heard of you very much, and yet you're putting this together, and anybody who's seen the video that you did way back when will notice that Treat Williams is in it, Marcia Strassman is in it.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Riegert has one of the funniest things I have ever seen in my life, the timing of the Frankfurter.
Yeah.
I mean, I have seen that now that it's been on YouTube, and I've watched it about a dozen times.
Yeah.
Every single time when Riegert, you know, I don't know, I think he doesn't drop the Frankfurter, it just sort of flies out of his hand.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Never have I seen timing like. I mean, I've seen Peter Riegert on Broadway, and he was never as funny as he was in that video.
Yeah. No, he cracked me up, too, the first time we did the first take.
Yeah.
I cracked up, and we had to do it again.
And whose idea was...
For all the people who don't know what we're talking about, they should go online and just take a look at Don't Nobody Move, This is a Heist, it's called. It's they can Google it, and they'll see the various... interpretations of it that other people have put on also, but they should play the one with the A in front of it.
Yeah.
That's mine.
And that is the original, and that's the one. But how did you know all these, either they were stars by then or were going to be pretty soon?
Well, I mentioned the Cafe Central before where I met Robin. All these actors, we hung out in this bar, this restaurant, and that's where we all met.
Huh.
And so I asked them, would they do this? And they knew some of my music, and they just Treat Williams got in his private plane where he was doing a play in Ohio, got into his plane, flew in, and stepped in my bathtub to do that scene, and then stepped out and flew back to do the play. And John Goodman was in two of my little films, two of the films on that album.
Oh, that's right. You know, if you look at Heist, you're not even going to recognize, if you have to look for him and realize he's the guy sitting at the table in a floral shirt.
He's a lean and mean John Goodman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was also in Midnight Trampoline, which is now up on YouTube as well.
Oh, finally. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. And Odyssey is too. And then one of my fans did a mashup of all the videos to a song that I recorded called Fire and Ice. That's there too, so it's really great. It's so nice that to know that people know your stuff.
I kind of gave a bit of a misnomer. We're talking to Tony Powers, by the way, of music and movie renown, and I made it sound like that was your first thing, like that video and Don't Nobody Move and Midnight Trampoline were your first songs, and nobody heard of you. When actually you were a Brill Building songwriter.
Oh yeah,
in the days of. Maybe a little bit after the days of Carole King and Neil Sedaka.
No, during. A little before and during. Oh, yeah. I worked with Dawn Kirshner when she was up at Screen Gems, Columbia Music, Alden Music. Yeah.
So what was it like?
Right down the hall.
Punching a clock, like going to work every day.
Yeah.
And knowing that your job, instead of making widgets or preparing legal briefs, was, okay, there's a piano, there's maybe a co-writer, and a tape recorder. Boom. What was that
like? Let's write a hit song. Well, you know, I started when I was really young. I was about 20 years old, and I met a lady named Beverly Ross on Broadway, and we went to her apartment on West 45th Street, and about a half hour later, we wrote a hit song called Remember Then, which a group called the Earls did. And I remember walking through Central Park and hearing my song on the radio. And that was the first time I'd ever heard a song of mine played on the radio. I'm a kid. I'm 20 years old. And I went, holy cannoli, that's my song. And what was it like? Okay, you'd go to the office, like you say.
Yeah.
And at that time, I got a contract after that with Lieber and Stoller. I don't know if you know who they are.
Yeah.
Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. They recorded The Coasters, The Drifters, and they did some of the greatest Stand By Me, some of the greatest things ever.
Right. There was a Broadway show dedicated to their music as well. Yeah. I'm blanking on...
Joe's Cafe.
Thank you, yes.
Yeah. And so you'd go to the office, and you'd sit down, and you'd look at this pad, and somebody would start playing the little thing on the piano, and you'd go something, and back and forth, and that's what it was like. And you know, you'd write five. For every 10 you'd write, maybe one of them was decent enough to go and make a demo.
And how many songs were you expected to put out, like, in a week to finish of any quality?
At least one or two.
Oh.
At least. But sometimes you'd write three and four, you know, and or five. And, again, maybe one of them was good enough to go in the office and play for Don Kirshner or Mike and Jerry or Aaron Schroeder, and they'd say, well, that's good. I'm going to shell out my money and let you make the demo, you see.
Oh, I see.
Right, you know, because we didn't have any money. We were kids. We were working for a company that would give us X amount of dollars each week up front. And then so you had to go in that office with a song that you liked and play it for them, and, you know, they had to look at you and say, well, I like that. Okay, go and make the demo.
So if you were there for a few weeks and you just kept putting out duds, they'd fire you because it wouldn't be...
Oh, probably.
Right.
Well, your contract would be up in a year and they'd let you go.
Huh. But if you came up with a real hit every now and again, they were happy to have you and they would hear what you were plugging.
They sure did. You know, and I didn't even know, Dave, I didn't even know until the advent of the Internet. I sort of stopped keeping track of my songwriting career, my commercial career at the Brill Building, when I left it, which was in the early 70s. I stopped keeping track. I went and looked at my discography, and I couldn't believe all the songs that I wrote that were recorded by other people. Boggled my mind to see it. I didn't even know Ricky Nelson did things of mine. I have no idea that certain people recorded my songs. Louis Armstrong recorded one of my songs.
What song did Louis Armstrong do? 98.6 or no?
I Like This Kind of Party.
Oh.
Jack Keller and I wrote it when I was working for Don Kirshner.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Are you reminded by royalty checks or is all that time gone? Oh, no, you still get, I'm assuming.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I still get because I wrote a lot of hits, quite frankly.
Oh. Great.
In my little career, in my little 7 years in the Brill Building, basically, I wrote with Phil Spector. I wrote with...
Okay, stop right there.
Yeah.
Stop right there. Was he... Well, we all know he's nuts. He was nuts back then. But how nuts was he when you knew him?
I would say eccentric.
Okay.
Eccentric. He was eccentric when I knew him, too. He would have a meeting in the back of his limousine.
Well,
that would be a quick meeting. He had, he was kind of eccentric, but very talented.
But you never got a wind of him being dangerous or being...
Well, everybody knew that he would... No.
Wait, carry a gun. Everybody knew that.
We were kids then. He was like 25, 27. We were kids.
Okay.
No, that stuff never happened at that point when I knew him.
Did he ever put his sound to one of your songs?
Oh, God, yeah. Do I ever put his sound to any of my songs?
No, no. In other words, did he ever take some of your songs and do the Phil Spector
production? Yeah. We wrote two hits. Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, that I wrote with Ellie Greenwich and Phil.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
That was a big hit for Darlene Love.
Mm-hmm.
Why Do Lovers Break Each Other's Hearts was top 40 for Bobby Stocks and the Blue Jeans.
Wow.
Yeah. And we had another thing called My Heart Beat a Little Faster, which wasn't a hit, but recorded. Yeah.
And did you know Tina Turner in those years as well?
Tina Turner, no.
Okay.
I didn't know I can Tina.
Okay. Now, you have, on the personal side, since you've been able, through royalties of your hits and through the folks that you know and from the acting, I guess you've carved out a career where you have you had to have a day job or have you been able to do the Tony Powers thing for the past few decades, no problem.
No problem. I you know something, one of the things about living a happy life is trying never to do what you don't want to do.
Oof.
I don't have a day job. I've never had a day job. Well, not after the age of 20.
Or not after the punch-the-clock years of the day job of writing songs, but even
That's the last day job I had. No, I've been able to, through acting and music, I own a home, and I'm a happy guy. And
you have a wife and kids?
I have had a wife, but no longer.
How did you kill her? No.
Yes, really. No, it just didn't work out. And I'm always too selfish to have children, I'll tell you the truth. I don't think I could have given them the time that I had to give to myself. I had to nurture myself. That's selfish, but...
Well, it's also honest. It's more honest than people mostly are when they say, oh, well, we have to have children, and, you know, of course we're going to have children, and it's going to be a little me.
Yeah, right. I think there's a little too much of that. Well, I'm happy for all the people that are happy with their children. I have lots of nephews and nieces, quote, unquote, and I'm very good with children as long as they're not mine, I guess.
We're talking with Tony Powers here in the neighborhood. And now Tony has been called, and this is on one of the websites that has a bio of his work, that, yes, when he was doing stuff in the Brill Building, it was that old kind of pop music stuff, the stuff that pre-Beatlesy rock and roll. Now, the things that he's been turning out have been compared to this odd cross between Jacques Brel and Nick Cave and jazz and Tom Waits and this whole melange of stuff that one person called you a retro futurist. How would you describe your music?
That's great. I can't describe my music. That's the problem. Because it's whatever I feel like writing. And you know, my ears go way back to, you know, through classical, blues, jazz, jazz from the 30s, Gershwin. So, yeah, it's whatever I feel like. I mean, I can't explain my stuff. You have to listen to my stuff. And I'm nothing. I'm okay. I'm pretty good. I like my stuff. It's different. And that's all I can say about it. It's different.
Well, here's the thing. You spent 7 years, as you said, being a punch-the-clock songwriter at the Brill Building, turning out hits, working with Don Kirshner, working with Ellie Greenwich, and writing with other folks. And then after
Lieber
7 years,
yeah.
I'm sorry, with Lieber and Stoller, what happened at that seventh year? There's a pretty cool story on the Internet about how you showed that you kind of wanted to do something else.
I wrote a song called... I was working for Don Kirshner, and I wrote a song called The Day I Lost My Watch.
Which, yeah,
is not exactly a commercial music title, and I went in and played it for him. The day I went in and played it for him, I was wearing a black silk suit, a silver silk tie, a white-on-white shirt, and I was barefoot. And this is how I went into his office and played him this The Day I Lost My Watch, which was a completely off-the-wall song, you know.
Now,
and he looked,
yeah,
at me and thought I was crazy, and he's, you know, and that's the day I guess I quit.
Now, you had never dressed like that before.
I always dressed like that, but never barefoot.
And also, I seem to recall, I will try and phrase this as delicately as we can, but the day you lost your watch, you decided to use something else to tell time. Is that?
Yes, it rhymes with watch.
Yes, yes. Yes,
it has, and it starts with a CR.
It also rhymes with clock,
yes,
in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. So... Yeah, I would figure that would be the... So, did you just burn out? Obviously. There's a dog
out?
Question.
Are you asking if I burnt out?
Yeah.
Okay, here's the deal. I didn't burn out at all.
Oh.
What happened is I got very political. I realized, well, you know, at that time it was the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was at that time. I lose track of all our wars.
Uh-huh. Unfortunately,
we've
had so many.
Yes. And at that time, it was the Vietnamese War that was getting us in a little trouble. Anyway, I got very political, and you just can't write that kind of stuff at that time in commercial music. I'm glad to say things have loosened up a bit. But, you know, I started writing that kind of thing, and it wasn't that I burnt out. It was that I burnt on.
Now, what year are we talking about?
More.
Yeah, well, this would have been 60, what?
69, 70.
Oh, that late. Well, actually, there was a lot of political music.
71, yeah.
It was rock. I mean, it wasn't the Brill Building rock, but you can certainly say that Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes and X amount of people were doing politically oriented material. The
Definitely.
Birds, even.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when you tried to move into as a solo artist, you did release an album or two, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
This was before the 1970s kind of, or the 80s rebirth, as it were.
Yeah, but nothing really ever happened to them. I just did a couple. Well, I made something called Homemade, which is a real sort of, I was very angry at the music business because, you know, you had to have a song with 3 minutes, and it had to have a hook and the first chorus, and it all had all these rules, and I got very angry at it, and I recorded a song called Homemade, an album called Homemade, and I specifically wrote handwritten liner notes. This album was recorded at home in my walk-up on a Sony TC using two used MPO tapes. I mean, it was just, you know, it was everything that pop music wasn't, it, using no reverb, no overdubbing, one track, no engineer, no rehearsal, no musicians, no studio, no producers, no gushing executives, no photographers, no nothing. That's what the album liner notes said, and it went on and on. I was really, you know, a little ticked off. at the fact that you had to write everything, had to be 3 minutes. So I every song, I timed every song at 2:22 on the, as my joke. But anyway, people just, what people ought to do is, rather than me saying all this, just go on to my website, www.tonypowersmusic.com. You know, they can read all about this stuff.
Well, it's a little more interesting to hear the person say it. But, yes, you can go to TonyPowersMusic.com, both to read some of this biographical stuff and also...
You can read some of the new lyrics.
Uh-huh.
Of the new CD. I didn't burn out. No, I burned on. I burned so hot that I kept burning, and I'm still burning. No, I also did in the 80s, I did the video album. The video EP, and which was part of a recorded LP. But the thing is, we named the music company on the album Translux, and Translux Corporation didn't like that, so we had to pull the album.
Oh, you're
no, no. Also, let me tell you a little thing about the video album. The video album was picked up by Sony. And they put it in the stores, and it turns out I had a guy who worked on the films as an assistant producer, and I had to fire him because he was really a troublemaker. He would change shots on me without telling me, and everything would be held up. And so I fired him.
Yeah.
And he happened to be in one shot, and he sued. He sued because we didn't have a release on him, because one of his jobs was the releases, and he ran out of releases the night that we filmed him. So he never gave me a release. So he sued. He sued us.
Oh, my God. Did he win?
Because I fired him. Well, Sony got so scared that they pulled the album no matter what.
Oh, for the
they
love of...
They just pulled the album out of the stores.
You know,
it's a good thing Night Flight played it. Because that's how people got to know it.
Yeah, one thing I am kind of wondering, I'm a little surprised. I mean, I've been listening to your new album called Who Could Imagine, and I'm enjoying both the political stuff and also some of the weird artsy cabaret stuff and the fun... bouncy stuff, and
yeah.
You do do a new version of Don't Nobody Move, This Is a Heist, which I don't blame you for. I mean, that's kind of the song that you're known for.
Well, it's just a new
for.
Vocal, actually. The track is the same.
I'm wondering about that, because it sounds, there are certain differences, but it's kind of close. I'm wondering why you didn't just use the original.
It is the original. I just did the redid the vocal.
Yeah, but why?
Oh, because, I don't know. I wanted to redo the vocal.
Cool.
You're welcome to play any, you know, one of them. I just wanted to redo the vocals, you know.
No, because there's also, I mean, not to critic, because the album's really cool, but there's something about that particular track on the new album where the fidelity is a little lower and a little muddier than the rest of it.
That's because it's the original track. We took it off the 24 track, which had to be baked. It was so old.
Oh, wow.
We had to bake it. No, in order to remix it, we had to get it off the 24, the original 24 track. As opposed to re-recording it. Now, I recorded this whole thing on a shoestring, so we didn't want to. So we used the original 24 track, and that's why. That is the one side on it that sounds a little muddy. So you know what we called? We figured, we said, well, we'll just think of it as a garage band thing.
Yeah.
As a grunge take. And then I love it as that. You know, I love it as what it is. It's raw, you know, grungy sounding, and that's what it is. Hi, it's Tony Powers. It was really, really fun to be on Dave Lefkowitz's show, Dave Gone By. You're listening to Dave's Gone By on New York's WGBB AM 1240. Enjoy.
Finishing up this delightful time with Tony Powers, the singer, the songwriter, the actor, do you feel now that there's been a sea change in the music industry? Have the chickens come home to roost? Is it kind of like now that the major labels are floundering and they don't know what to do and they're losing all sorts of money and they're firing everybody? Are you happy about that because now it's back in the hands of the artists, sort of? Or is it just as scary because now everything's so fragmented that if an artist sells 10,000 copies of a CD, that's a major hit?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't think about that. Here's what I think about. I think about that music is becoming so... inclusionary now.
Mm.
That's what it is. I mean, I listen to these kids. They're doing stuff that I wanted to do in the 60s and that I've been doing. But they've all caught up to me. They're past me. I think it's wonderful, the amount of good stuff that I hear, that's all I think about. I whether or not the record companies are, whether it's karma or whatever, what's happening to them doesn't concern me. I hope everybody does well, and I'm just glad that all the kids are writing such great stuff. I hear things that blow me away.
Well, who are you listening to these days? What bands? What people?
Well, when I listen to these kids, I'll listen to a kid named like Soup John Stevens. You know?
He does these albums Arcade, about places. Yeah.
Yeah, Arcade Fire. I really don't listen too much. But when I do listen, I listen to classical music. Well, when I do listen to these kids, I'm just amazed at the stuff I hear. I think it's great. It's brilliant, a lot of it. You know, and a lot of it comes out of, you know, these guys. I'm sure they listen to Frank Zappa at some time, because there are a lot of things that sound to me sometimes like it was incarnated Frank Zappa.
Were you a big Zappa listener? And did he influence you a bit?
He's a giant.
Well, yeah.
He's a giant. I don't even approach his talent. He's a musical giant. I mean, my head is like his, but he's got the chops.
Hmm.
He really does. He has the chops.
Well,
he's great.
You've got a few chops yourself. I mean, I like a lot of the music on your new CD. Of course, everybody, if you haven't by now gone and surfed over to YouTube to see some of the old stuff, you should do that too. Just look for Tony Powers. Are you going to do some videos to go with your new CD?
I'm thinking about doing one for Cartoon, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking about that, and in black and white, I think I'd like to do it. Yeah, and now it's kind of less expensive to do those things, too, because, you know, you get a camcorder and you got a video.
Pretty much.
You just have to sit down beforehand and really, really plan out exactly what you're going to do. That's how we made the films that I made, which I made them on a shoestring, and yet they look like theatrical pieces because we planned them out so good beforehand. That's what we did with this CD, too. We planned it out really well beforehand.
Well, we'll go out with another song from the Who Could Imagine CD, the new CD by Tony Powers. First of all, just also want to thank you so much for taking the time to be in the neighborhood with us here.
My pleasure.
Wishing you the best of luck with the CD, with all the other acting that you're doing, and with the music that you're working on from now until the next time you're here.
Let me just plug it one more time.
Go
it's
for
called
it.
Who Could Imagine. You can get it on, you can check it out on CD Baby online. You can go to my website, www.tonypowersmusic.com. I hope you enjoy a little bit of, what are you going to play?
Well, probably Cartoon.
Okay.